This is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping the local area. Inside Douglas County is presented by Concrete Builder Supply. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Friday afternoon, checking around the Umpqua Valley. Things going on. State Representative Virgil Osborne, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Well, a lot of things happening lately, but let's kind of go from a different direction to some extent. You had a fair booth last week, and I'm kind of curious what that was like. What'd you hear from people?
Yeah, we had a great fair. It was hot, unfortunately, but of course we were in an air conditioning room, so that helped a little bit. But I always like to keep my fair booth pretty benign so that people, we're happy to speak with Democrats, Republicans, Independents, whatever people want to come by and express their opinions, voice their opinions on different things. And we got a lot of opinions. There's never a shortage of those in Douglas County. We always get lots of things that people want to talk about. By far and away, the most important thing that continues to come up is this special session that we're going to have here at the end of the month. And people, frankly, are just concerned, a little worried about, tax increases on their fuel and registration on their car and tax increases in their payroll checks. And so that was probably the number one thing that we heard the most about. Interestingly enough, I think probably the second thing we heard the most about was our own podcast that we've now turned that to Tuesday nights, and then we've gone live with it. And the idea behind our podcast is to keep transparency with the public. So, we allow, basically quite frank conversation on that podcast. And I had no idea I had so many people listening and so many people that were actually counting on those days. So, again, we'll have another one coming up this Tuesday, and it's a town hall. And we're going to focus strictly on the transportation package. And we'll also have Christine Drazen joining us and possibly Lucetta Elmer as well. Christine is our Republican caucus leader, and Lucetta is our vice deputy leader.
Do you feel like there are people at the fair that you wouldn't necessarily meet otherwise?
Oh, I think so. Particularly on Senior Day, we had a lot of folks come in that, they really don't get out and go to town halls, and they don't really do a lot of that kind of interactive stuff in public. So it's nice when they come by and put a name to the face and they get familiar with who we are. And yeah, it was I would say this year it was definitely busier than last year. I don't know what the attendance was at the fair, but it seemed and felt really busy in the building.
How different is the summer season as a legislator? Talk about some of the other things you've been out doing.
Yeah, so summer season is great because we actually get a chance to interact with the folks in the district. And like I always tell everybody, when we're not in session, you're safe. We're not gonna add taxes to you or any other or pass laws you don't agree with when we're not in session. So I use the interim for basically interaction, and we do a lot of events, go to a lot of just about everything we can go to meet people and talk about what their concerns and needs are, and actually start forming new ideas for new bills, and it really, to me, this is the part of the job that I love the most.
What do you think the average voter expects a legislator to do? Do a lot of people really not understand what the role is?
Well, interesting that you asked that question, because part of the reason I like going to fair so much is because we actually get to explain to people what the process of governance looks like. And you would be amazed to see that most people have no idea what it is we do. I have a lot of people that will just basically come into the booth and say, you need to go up there and change this. You need to go to Salem and change this and change that. They don't necessarily understand the process of how things work and how the building works. And so it gives us a chance to kind of sit down and explain, here's the process of a bill. Kyle, you and I are probably old enough to remember on Saturday mornings when the cartoons played, there was the cartoon about, I'm just a bill, I'm only a bill, and they sent me here in Capitol Hill. It's funny that obviously those aren't on TV anymore, but the reality of it is that process, I learned that when I was, 12 years old, watching cartoons on Saturday morning. That's just one of many, but it was really nice to be able to explain the process and how bills work and laws work. And, most people don't realize that if something goes through the House, it has to go to the Senate. So it's not like, you can just pass a bill in the House and it becomes law. It has to go to the Senate. They have to agree with it. Sometimes it comes back to the House for concurrence, and then it has to go to the governor's office to sign.
And sometimes it has to be written very differently because of other already in place statutes that it might impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, we get lots of ideas for bills that people come to us, approach us. They want us to, you know, work on this or work on that. I mean, you name it, everything you can think of. So the first litmus test is it has to be constitutional. So we have to make sure that whatever it is that we write and whatever it is that goes through the process has to meet the constitutional parts of being able to do it. So we will take the concept, and the concept could just be one sentence or it could be, you know, a paragraph or whatever it is. We'll take that concept to our legislative council in Salem, and they will actually take that concept and put it into writing. Now, sometimes those one paragraph bills become 47-page bills, and all of that has to meet the criteria. Then once it gets to that point, it can go to committee. And then even still, there are bills that are challenged, you know, after passage, like, for instance, the gun bills, the constitutionality of them.
Now, talk about the volume of emails you get.
So right now it's a little slower. We'll get on, you know, summer days like this when we don't really have anything super pressing, we'll still get 50 or 60 emails a day. Now, with the special session coming up, there's times where we'll get, you know, 100. When there's a really controversial bill, for instance, like a gun bill, or even the abortion bill, or the some of those bills that we heard in 23, we'll get 200-300 emails a day, and some of them are not very nice. So I have staff, and most all of my emails go through my staff. They'll flag emails that are super important that I need to respond to right away, and then we kind of have a hierarchy of how we handle inbound emails and inbound mail in general, because literally it would be a full-time job for a legislator to sit there and respond to every single thing.
Now, does anybody actually send you a letter through the U.S. Postal Service anymore?
We do, actually, yeah. We get a lot of postcards. I just got some this week. Probably, I don't know, if I had to guess, maybe in the neighborhood of, 10 or 15 a month. When we're in session, we'll get more. Sometimes they'll come through the building and just pass them out. But a lot of that mail goes to the building, and then they have a bulk mail system, and they'll bring it up to your office once a week.
Wow. And I know that texting, even with public officials, is becoming more of something. Obviously, you don't just give out your number to everybody, but sometimes I've heard of folks, different positions, who have a special number that is not their number to contact them directly, but to just sort of communicate about what you think about things. And I think that's probably going to get more common.
Well, it is, and honestly, I pretty much freely give out my text or my personal cell number because it's the number that I use, and I'm very transparent. I always want to continue to stay that way. I want people to be able to contact me, and on the same note, I also don't want to be abused, but, that's just not the case. Most people have been very respectful with the time and call when need be or text when need be. Now, what's interesting is text messages also count as public record. So if you're messaging back and forth regarding something that is, involves the public, they can have a public records request on your text. So I tend to keep it pretty benign, but we do, as legislators, we have our own messaging system back and forth. So we may sit on the House floor, it won't be in a text, but we may sit on the House floor while we're doing bills and passing things, and we may be sending messages, back and forth to each other pretty frequently regarding some bills and some testimony.
And the fact that all that is public record, sometimes people forget, and periodically it has landed folks from either side of the aisle in a little bit of trouble.
Yes, it has. And it works both ways. The people that the inbound messages can also get the person inbound in trouble just as much as they can, go after the legislator for saying whatever it is they may say. Now, for me, fortunately, I don't hide anything, so I don't worry too much. I mean, I lay things out the way they are, and that's how I've always been, and I'd rather hit a problem head on than hide behind it, and I'll never change.
All right, back with more State Representative Virgil Osborne in a moment. The interview podcast after 1 at 541radio.com, 1245 at News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1247, Lars Larson at 1, State Representative Virgil Osborne in with us this afternoon. And early this week, we got emails from some of the legislators about things we've kind of already heard about, but put out a little bit more on paper, made things a little bit more official. And I want to talk about a couple of those at least. One of those was funds that came late in the session for the Rock Creek Hatchery. Talk about that.
Yeah, so that was something that myself and Senator Brock Smith have been working on for quite some time. And, of course, we wanted to get more money for it. The misconception is that there's going to be some kind of new tax to cover that. That's not true. This is general funds money that it comes in what they call the Christmas tree bill that happens at the end of every long session. And it was the 5006 bill. We have not really announced. We knew we had got it into the bill, and we had not announced whether or not we won the money because the governor was extremely upset with us over the ODOT transportation bill. And if you're a Republican, you had a bullseye on your back because, we torpedoed her bill. So the governor has the ability to line item veto anything out of the bill that she'd like. And there was tons and tons of different things in that bill. Well, one of the things was the Rock Creek Fish Hatchery. And we had $1.4 million involved in that. That's a biennium grant. But the money will now be combined with what the tribe is already doing up there. So it's kind of, we were kind of at a point where the hatchery was going to completely close, or if we got some state money, we could keep it open and we could actually start the process again in partnership with the tribe. So that happened. This money has allowed that to happen. And so, at least for the time being, I don't think there's any danger of the hatchery closing. And we really need that hatchery to operate. We need to get our fish runs back. And this is just a really good step in that direction. So, now I've been asked and was asked several times at the fair, what about the insurance money? And there was, I believe, $13 million of insurance money that has not been spent on the hatchery. It can't be spent anywhere else. It wasn't actually received. The money's there from FEMA and it's still available. Our hope is that money will eventually be, taken in by the hatchery, and they will use that to actually update a lot of the processes there.
Well, and some of the buildings and things like that, right?
Yeah, well, it's amazing that the one building that never got burnt was the newest building, and it's part of they do a lot of teaching, interactive kids stuff there as well, so it still stands. The other buildings were mostly maintenance buildings, and of course the concrete runs for the water and stuff, they really didn't get hurt that bad, but all the other buildings burned to the ground, so there needs to be, I don't know if it's a $13 million rebuild, it could be more, but there definitely needs to be some work done there.
What about for the Roseburg VA? And I've had people ask about that because they've said, didn't that get allocated already?
So it did, and it has to be redone every 2 years. And so that money becomes basically something that unfortunately the majority party can take and use somewhere else. So we were able to get it reallocated again, and if we have to, we'll go back and do it again in the next session. But that money still stands, and it still goes toward the Veterans Home in Roseburg. Now, that money is only 30% of the overall funds needed. The rest of it has to come from the feds, and that's what we're counting on, Representative Hoyle and Wyden and Merkley to come through and get us the federal money, which is about another $66 million to finish this project out and actually build the home. So we will continue to fight for that money that originally was started by Representative, at the time, Representative Freeman, who's now our commissioner. He was the one that actually started this. It's been 15 years ago, and it took until last year to actually get the first allocation, and we'll keep fighting for that as long as it takes to get that thing built.
And I know, talking to some of the D.C. folks, they're trying to get it in the federal process this year for the upcoming fiscal year. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned about that at all, given all the shifts in D.C. from the administration?
Yeah, it's always a concern. I feel like the Trump administration does respect veterans, and I hope that this is something that they'll move forward on. Now, Oregon is a special case with the Trump administration. We have a governor that has been nothing but a problem for the Trump administration, and so it's very much up in the air. So we'll just have to see where it goes and keep pressuring and trying to get it done.
Now, as well, $500,000, I think, was the figure for some training for Sutherland Fire. Explain that.
Yeah, so we also had the opportunity to get some training money for the facility and equipment for the Sutherland Fire Department. And I know, Kyle, earlier you had asked if we had any photos or anything. I'm sorry, I don't yet. But that was another one of my asks for, and Senator Brock Smith was as well part of that. And we got the money. So, you know, I have always been a staunch supporter of first responders. I am a first responder myself. My heart goes out for the firemen in this community and the law enforcement in this community and the hard work that they do. And, you know, it's a thankless job. So we're happy to be able to step in and have the state give some of our tax dollars, I guess you call it, that actually are going for a good cause.
And as we look towards this upcoming session, has it evolved much in terms of what you're expecting?
No. So there is some speculation. In fact, the Oregon Catalyst had a story this morning that there is some fallout in the Democrat Party on the Senate side that they don't think they're going to have the votes to pass this transportation tax. I know on the House side, the governor has originally 2 weeks ago told our party that she's going to go it alone. She just wants us to provide quorum and she will go it alone. We really can't deny quorum on something like this. We're going to have to show up. I believe there will be four of us that show up. I will be one of them. But they are going to have to pass this tax on their own. Now, recently, the governor has also came back to our leader and said, what do we need to do to get Republican buy-in on this? And, you know, the first thing that our response was, you know, get rid of some of the DEI and get rid of some of the environmental process money that, you know, for, you know, environmental protection money. And she said, you know, that's not going to happen. So, I mean, they're on their own. They need 36 votes to get it out of the House. They have 36 Democrats in the House. I don't know. We're going to find out here shortly.
If if it doesn't go through, I mean, she could always call another special session, right?
She can, and that's where it gets dicey. She can continue to call sessions. You know, she's the governor. She can do whatever she wants. We can't deny those sessions. If we do, we'll just lose seats over it. And plus, people put us in those positions to do our job. And part of doing our job is to defend the people of our districts and do what's best for our districts. This tax, this transportation tax, is not good for our districts. It's not good for the state. And I know that the Democrat Party knows this. So whoever votes yes on this is probably in jeopardy of losing their position.
And do you feel like that's the case for, I mean, even very progressive districts?
I believe that even Multnomah County and some of the very progressive districts are starting to look at what the, you know, what's happening in our state and looking at the mismanagement and, you know, basically the thumb in the eye of what they're doing to the Trump administration and realizing we stand to lose $38 billion in revenue because of it. I think people are finally starting to wake up and go, look, we can't operate this way as a state. You know, $38 billion of our $138 billion budget comes from the federal government. And right now, the federal government is not in favor of Oregon.
And do you see this not just with ODOT, but certainly having the potential to impact other funding areas?
Well, yeah, absolutely. For starters, you know, Medicaid is gonna be affected by it. Doesn't have to be. All we have to do is comply to the federal law, and we would be fine. But our you know, frankly, our government in Oregon has become dependent on those federal funds, and then also our school system. I mean, our school system stands to lose $1 billion, which will be a tragedy for us. But again, all we have to do is you know, get into agreement with Title IX, quit allowing men and women's sports, you know, the basic federal law, and we would be fine.
And what happens if in 3 years the federal administration goes the other direction?
We'll have to wait and see what happens in 3 years. Hopefully we still have a state and we haven't completely crashed. Right now, I get emails and messages and phone calls all the time from people telling me they're leaving the state along with the jobs. So, you know, hopefully, I just don't know, but I feel like the American people and I feel like particularly Oregonians have got to the point where it's like, look, we've had enough. It's time to start getting back on the horse.
State Representative Virgil Osborne, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Kyle.
1257 News Radio, 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
You You've been listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN. A daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. It's presented by Concrete Builder Supply. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it around and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications. Stay connected with local news and information. News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.